Hey, again, my name is Brian, and I'll be the administrator on today's call. If you have any problems or questions, you can email me directly at editor@marketingexperiments.com, and I'll try to get back to you as quickly as I can. You should have already received an email message detailing how to log into the notes for today's conference, but if you'd like to point your web browser directly to that page, it would just be mecgroups.com/MEC_research_log. Again, mecgroups.com/MEC_research_log. And we'll ask you to refresh that page several times throughout the conference as we add some tables and other data. Some key commands that you might find useful on your telephone, *4 will increase the volume on your line if you're having any trouble hearing. And *6 will mute your line, which is useful if you're in a noisy room. And then to unmute your line, if you have any questions, just hit *6 again. I'll go ahead and go through our upcoming web conferences and research that we'll be releasing. On Wednesday, May 18th, that's this coming Wednesday, at 4 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, I'll be hosting a conference on overstock auctions as a marketing channel. On Wednesday, June 8th, at 4 p.m. also, we will be testing pay-per-click ad copy. Again, those are Wednesday, May 18th and Wednesday, June 8th. So if you'd like to participate in either one of those, you can go ahead and send me an email at editor@marketingexperiments.com, and I will get a spot reserved for you. Some upcoming research briefs that we'll be releasing. Just in the next couple of days, we'll be releasing part two of our marketing blueprint. Also, we'll be releasing this report on spam and four other reports that we have planned in the short term are overstock auctions in the marketing channel, testing your order path, testing your pay-per-click ad copy, and how to prevent click fraud. One more time, the URL for the notes today is mecgroups.com/MEC_research_log. My email address is editor@marketingexperiments.com if you have any questions. And at this time, I'd like to introduce Dr. Flint McLaughlin, who will be our primary presenter today. There's a brief biography of Dr. McLaughlin at the bottom of your notes. Dr. McLaughlin.
Thank you, Brian. We're going to get started right away. I have in front of me two documents. The first is our latest report, including our own research related to spam, and I have a copy of the 108th Congress of the United States of America's session notes and the bill associated with, in fact, quote, controlling the assault of solicited pornography and marketing act of 2003, or what is popularly known as the Canned Spam Act. And as that document is here on my left, and with our report, we're going to begin. I will only tell you this as we start. I find the whole topic of spam critical and essential to our operations as a publisher. But on the other hand, it's not a topic that you would expect to attract as much attention as it does, even for this particular conference. We had, again, many, many registrations for this, and it surprises me because we're talking about a subject that in itself doesn't drive up, you know, your pay-per-click sales, or in itself does not drive up a specific marketing channel. But I think most of us have come to realize that if we're going to survive online, this is a paramount issue. And it does affect your marketing, as you'll see in the studies that we've done here and as we're going to be talking about. It affects your open rate, it affects the success of your email campaigns, and it affects the ROI if you consider the risk associated with clients and so on. So we're going to begin that with the first question. That's how much are you risking when you send a marketing email? Now, not all spam comes from criminals in some abandoned warehouse. During the course of our research, we've came across a U.S. retailer who had unknowingly received more than 80 spam complaints in the past 3 months. And they were simply sending periodic specials and updates to their past customers. As the performance of these emails started to diminish, we found that much of the email was not even reaching their customers, let alone being opened, read, or acted upon. There's a chart we're going to put in your notes, and if you've got your note page open and you'll hit the refresh button, you'll see the latest chart. It details the messages sent, messages returned, percent returned, messages opened, percent opened, click-through rate, spam complaints, and potential fines and risk per click. With all of that in mind, I'm just making a note here. There's some interesting numbers. We'll not read every number in the chart. It's in front of you, and it'll also be released in the brief that we send out. In addition to that, this conference is being recorded, and a script of that or an audio file will be available on our site shortly. But what you want to notice most of all is probably, first of all, that these were small campaign tests, campaign A, B, and C, over a three-month total, sub-samples. And in these samples, you'll notice the percent returned range from 16.38% to 31.96%. And though these were returned addresses, this was not a list that was gleaned through some type of unethical harvesting procedure or purchased. These were actual customers who were being emailed, and yet the return rates hovered up nearly 30% or right around there during much of these tests. You'll also want to note that campaign A had spam complaints of 20, the first one 21, and campaign C at 42. It would be interesting to aggregate and notice the doubling from campaign B to campaign C, and ask ourselves whether or not this is because the customer list was older by the time we went through campaign C. And I'd like to, in a later study, aggregate how quickly, aggregate the statistics so that I can answer this question: how quickly does a list age in today's email environment? But you'll notice spam complaints for campaign C nearly doubled. Also, the three-month total was at 83. And essentially, there was an associated risk per click of $24.87 for each of these campaigns. $14.94 for campaign B, $22.80 for campaign C, with a three-month total of $20.47 in it as a risk per click factor. That is high, and if you're a retailer or a publisher online now, these numbers ought to frighten you, because there are significant risks. Seeing right now if spam complaints is not as effective as it could be, but that's going to change eventually, and certainly it won't be perfect, but all of us are at risk of being unfairly maligned. And in this case, we must point out that this was a legitimate retailer, respectable, with a 5-star rating in retail, and this person was being accused of spam with every mailing to the extent that the risk per click were absolutely unacceptable. So with that in mind, we need to get into this spam issue a little bit more, but I'm going to just stop for a moment, and I'm going to let Brian, for all of those that just joined us, give us one more update that just joined us, and we're going to get into the next part of the conference. Go ahead, Brian.
Sure. My email address is editor@marketingexperiments.com. If you are having any trouble logging into the meeting, the URL is mecgroups.com/mec_research_log. And we'll ask you to refresh that page as we add some additional tables throughout the conference. Key commands that you might find useful: *4 will increase the volume on your line, and *6 will mute your line if you're in a noisy room.
As we're moving through this, I would like to point out that Jalali Hartman, who's on our research team, actually wrote this piece and conducted the majority of the research. But there were a number of contributors that it would be worth recognizing. Brian, who, as always, and has done a faithful job of working on issue after issue with us, has done a tremendous job here. Tom Colzer and Ann Mitchell and Sarah Baldwin and Cliff Lane are all contributed to this. And I just want to point that out because I appreciate their hard work. And I shall move on and look at the next page of the notes and begin to talk through you about the impact of the study that we just did. The most alarming factor in these campaigns was the automatic $41,500 fine in the state that could have been imposed by the state of Florida if these 83 spam complaints had all been pursued. Most illegal unsolicited email still goes unpunished while we wait for technology to catch up with legislation. But there's of course, in the interim, a great deal of spam. The International Spam Coalition, Spamhaus, which is German, H-A-U-S, reports that 80% of all spam comes from just 200 sources. State and federal agencies are beginning to team up with ISPs to bring down these spam rings, and recent busts resulted many years in prisons and millions of dollars in fines. Your business may not be at risk of getting slapped with a $1 million lawsuit because of your latest email offer, but the fact of the matter is that you could very likely be breaking the law, and if prosecuted, you could be liable. And I'll tell you something, just to deviate from my notes, one of the things that we have to be concerned about is So often these laws are ineffective when it comes to stopping the professional criminal, and very effective at hurting the honest business who simply made a mistake, or in many cases has not made a mistake. MEC is especially careful about our own list. We're very involved in the spam issues, but we've had spam complaints. And we've done all that we can to be absolutely accurate with the email addresses, so much so that we have to go to extreme limits. For instance, though we have a very clear subscription or unsubscribe process, many people just hit reply on email, and when they do ask to be removed from your list, that means that after every send, we have often thousands of replies coming in with people hitting that reply to us. Some are requests to change an address, some are requests to be removed from the list, et cetera, et cetera. We have to manually go through every single one of these people who's hit a return, every feedback, and we manually will go through and remove any name that's requested on, despite the fact that we've made it very clear that if anyone wants to unsubscribe, all they have to do is click on a certain link. I want to tell you that in spite of all that, we've still had a few spam complaints, and there are many people on this phone who may be honest, and they may be doing the job the best they know how, and you're the ones that are likely to suffer the most from some of these laws. Because the professional criminal is aware of the law, and he's doing everything possible to keep from getting caught. You are a very visible target. And often it's groups like you and I that could face prosecution, and really, when it's unfair. I have to say that the ISPs across the country, out of fear, have been very unfair with many of the retailers and publishers who are running a legitimate email operation. They will quickly shut you down when you have complaints without even finding out if you can verify that that is an email address that you honestly harvested or that you received because someone opted in. Each state has adopted its own legislation to handle spam, but to give an idea of the potential risk, imagine that you spam someone in Michigan and the font size of your unsubscribe instruction is smaller than the main body of your message. If you do, you can get in significant trouble. Use our free spam fine calculator to see what your maximum fine could be. Now, if you may want to turn there right now, Brian. I'll let Jalali, tell them the link number, and I'll let Jalali explain this calculator. This is something you can download and use if you're a retailer or a publisher. Go ahead, guys.
Sure. That's link number 4. Go ahead, Jalali.
For those of you that have just joined us, it's if you want to find that link, it's just go to the blog that we're running this from. That's mecgroups.com/mec_research_log, and you'll see it's link number 4. And the calculator is simple. It's really not meant to to be used in any kind of legal any kind of legal situation. But essentially, what it is just it gives you a sense for even with just some real minimum levels of fines. If you're just talking about say like I think in this case we're using the state, just the state fine for Florida per email incident. At $500 a spam complaint, it starts to add up, and that's the thing that I don't think most people realize, because at least most retailers aren't realizing, because there isn't a lot of prosecution going on right now against sort of small retailers and or medium-sized retailers or marketers. They've started to go after some of the big, those top 200 that are really causing problems and costing everyone a lot of money. But when it really comes down to it, you are exposing yourself. And if a group of consumers or a group of your customers wanted to get together and cause trouble, essentially the CAN spam legislation put some things in place that do protect you as a retailer or a marketer, but also sort of open things up for if someone wanted to go after and take some legal action. So give you an idea of magnitude of what could happen.
Okay, so that's Marketplace Snapshot. Well, you've got the link. You can download that tool. You're welcome to keep it and use it, and perhaps it'll help you as you're thinking about your risk. Now, let's keep moving. We've got lots of material to cover. We want to get practical, talking to you about what to do to prevent yourself from getting in trouble on this spam issue. And one of the questions is, how much does spam cost your business? We did another study, which I'm leading up to, The last data table, if you've just joined us, is in your notes, and it's been explained, and you can get the recording later. For now, let's move on. How much does SPAM cost? $20 billion would provide food, shelter, clothing, and education to each of the 83 million homeless children in India for the next 10 years. But $20 billion is also the amount that the world spends each year in lost productivity and technology as a direct result of spam or unsolicited commercial email. And no one likes it, with the possible exception of a handful of marketers that generates it, thriving on a minuscule, notice this, 0.0036% conversion rate. And the reason is that, you know, they can do that because the majority of the real costs are incurred by the recipients of the spam, not the senders of the spam, which is what differentiates it from, you know, even from direct mail. The amount of spam email that many people receive is overwhelming, prompting them to switch ISPs or email addresses or implement commercial spam blockers that create yet another cost of doing business online. Each of us becomes increasingly aggravated by the amount of spam we receive. We are especially concerned with the impact that spam has on the email newsletter publishing community. With over 50% of the world's email taking the form of UCE, legitimate newsletters are getting lost in a sea of junk. We are also concerned that the amount of time and energy we spend processing junk email each day could hurt productivity. And we are interested to see, and we're interested to see, just how much spam costs the average U.S. company. So we sampled two groups of incoming emails in a small study, and this is what we discovered. And this will be in your notes. You can refresh your chart. 67% of the email coming in to group A was spam. 33% was regular email. In group B, 70% of the email was spam. 30% was regular email. What you need to understand, basically, is that on average, 68% of all email that our test groups received was spam. Further analysis of the content of the spam revealed the following ratios. And you may want to refresh your notes again. There'll be a new table appearing. Of the mail that came in, here's a breakdown. We said once before, 30% was regular email. 22% was product offers. 16% was prescription drugs. 9% was pornography. 8% was miscellaneous. 4% personal ads. 4% travel. 4% credit cards. And 3% money laundering. I assume that references the Nigerian money scheme and others, which are really more just laundering. We're talking about fraud. They're trying to get into your accounts. What you need to understand is illegal prescription, drug offers, pornography, and product offers made up 47% of all of the spam our test groups received. That is a horrific number, and it's costing us a fortune. It's not hard to imagine that other companies are experiencing a similar loss of productivity due to junk email. With over 50% of the world's email being spam, it's probably costing each of us a lot more than we think. So what are the laws on spam, and how can we be compliant? Well, the CAN spam law refers specifically to Federal Senate Bill 877, which was signed into law by President Bush in December of 2003. As I said at the beginning of this conference, I have a copy of that whole bill sitting here on the table next to me, and it's pretty substantial. This bill should be taken seriously, and already it has resulted in hundreds of millions of dollars in lawsuits and even jail time for some spammers. The primary purpose of the CAN spam law is to put some regulation in place around email marketing. CAN spam is not just designed to protect consumers from spam, but also helps legitimate email marketers to get messages in front of their customers. If CAN spam helps to curtail spam, then legitimate email marketing will receive more attention from recipients. Ann Mitchell is CEO of the Institute for Spam and Internet Public Policy. And Ann was kind enough to provide a quick outline for email marketers who might want to make sure they are CAN spam compliant. I think it's useful to consider this. Let me just make a note. I think it's useful to kind of reduce this big, thick bill that I have in front of me down to something that you can walk away with in 5 or 6 points and digest what it is you need to know. And that's the attempt right now, if we can do that for you. Based on our research and our conversations with Ann, we're going to make these 6 recommendations that we think are key, and then we're going to give you some additional insights that are a bit deeper than this. The first is there must be a way for the recipient to opt out permanently from your list. Keyword here is permanent, which goes beyond simply unsubscribing. In other words, you will have to maintain some kind of purge file that will prevent these permanently opted out users from being added back to your list. That's very important. That can get you in trouble. So develop a way to purge your list and make sure you're not getting people inadvertently added back. Number two, while a user does not specifically need to opt into your list, you may, did you hear that? They do not specifically have to opt into your list. You may not send email to list you purchased, stole, or compiled unethically. In other words, only contact your customers or those who have specifically requested information. Now, I think that word purchase needs to be qualified, Jalali. You can certainly steal purchased lists. It's very tricky doing this, and it's very dangerous. But you can purchase lists where those people have agreed to in exchange for something to allow you to email them. But you cannot, say, go to another email publisher, cut a deal with him behind the scenes, purchase his list from him, and then just mail out your offer to his list, unless his list has given him permission for you, or not necessarily for you, but for him to use their names in some other way, as in with an alliance or as in selling them to you. Is that accurate? Would you say that accurate, Jalali, in terms of how I've defined that?
Yes, I believe so.
Okay. The laws are complicated, and I want to be careful. I'm being recorded. I'm trying to say it right. Essentially, I just want to point out that you have to be careful about this word purchasing a list, because it is possible to purchase a list where people have opted in and said that it's all right for you to email them. But just purchasing a list and mailing to people who have not given you permission to do so can get you in severe trouble. Number three, you must include a physical mailing address, that's a street address, in every email message indicating who you are and how you can be contacted. Number four, if the email is an advertisement, it must be clearly marked as such in either the subject line or the first lines of the body of the message, or both. Number five, sexually oriented material must be clearly marked as such in the subject line. And number six, you may not mask where your email is being sent from. This regulation also precludes using fake names or illegal servers to send email. Now, those are the big six. And these cover most of the major regulations for email marketers. However, to be sure that you are fully compliant with Can Spam, you should have your legal counsel review the full legislation here. And that is link number what?
You can get information on Can Spam on links 6 through 8 on the notes.
Okay, links 6 through 8 take you to the actual source, the legislation, etc. So that will help you. And that will get you to the FTC site and other places. Key point is this, the Can Spam legislation has laid out some very clear guidelines for commercial email marketing. It's important to be Can Spam compliant to improve email marketing effectiveness, as well as to avoid significant financial and even prison-based penalties. In addition to federal laws, most states have enacted additional legislation and automatic penalties for spammers. So how can you improve your email marketing to avoid sending spam to your customer base? I mean, going beyond these six rules, we got in touch with Tom Kolzer, who is the CEO of email marketing firm AWeber Systems. And Tom has certainly seen a lot of email in the 7 years his company's been in the email marketing solution business, and he's contributed significantly to the following advice. I'll go over that with you. So let's talk about that. Number one, be aware of filters. Spam filters have made it increasingly difficult to get your permission-based email delivered to your audience. Open rates and click-through rates are affected by as much as 20 to 30% due to incorrect spam filter settings. Best thing you can do is attempt to educate your subscribers to put your domain on their whitelist. Your best and perhaps only opportunity to do this is when they initially subscribe or first place an order with you. Otherwise, they may never know they are blocking your email. Now, not only do you ask them to do that, but I think, and I'm just going to talk off, this is not in my notes, but I really think you're going to see a stronger move to RSS feeds and other ways to get content piped directly to the desktop. People got tired of toolbars, and they certainly got tired of lots of little downloadable utilities, but there still are ways to get your site or your message somehow past the whole process of trying to fight spam filters. And I would recommend that anybody in the publishing industry be thinking about that. I think it's going to be significant in years to come. Moving on. Get unambiguous permission. Make sure that the people who ask for your information have actually requested to be on your list. This is the number one step in the battle for deliverability. For most email publishers and marketers, confirmed or verified opt-in is recommended. This means that a new list member is sent an email message, and when they're added, they must click a link or reply to actually be added to your list. Now, let me just stop there. We've been conducting research on how to increase the number of people that comply with a request for verification. as in what some people call double opt-in. We're going to be releasing an issue of the journal in the future that talks about how to write the messaging in your email. Now, this applies to publishers or to retailers in some sense, because you may have to verify even as a retailer anymore. And the bottom line is, if you're using double opt-in, we have seen that the wording of the second message can easily double the number of people who you actually are able to get to click or press the reply button and become a permanent member or a member, a subscriber on your list. Let me point out that most of these messages that I see when we conduct studies or look what other people are doing are written poorly. And I often have seen numbers as low as 8, 6, 9% of the people who originally subscribed that actually continue through the process when you ask them to respond. So this is of high, high importance, and we'll be doing an issue on the future. Number three, good subscriber addresses. As your website visitors often ask for their real or primary email address, instead of specify that you need that instead of the free email addresses like Yahoo or Hotmail. Free email addresses tend to be throwaway accounts and typically have a shorter lifetime. Number four, maintain your list. MEC regularly goes through its list. We just purged 40,000. Brian, how many names did we purge?
I think even more than that. I think more than 50,000.
We purged more than 50,000 names from our list because they were unproductive. Now, some of you, might find that shocking, because the reality is, the more names on your list, the larger you sound, and the more you might be worth somebody's asset book. But you know what? The truth is, the only names that are good are the names that are good. And sending emails out to unproductive names is futile. And so we've done several purges, and we've purged our list, and we have shrunk it. But the list we have is a good list. Also, some ISPs track what percentage of your messages bounce and may block you if you continue to attempt to deliver messages to non-existent mailboxes. So, it's to your advantage to just get that list clean. Plan your, by the way, one of the things that I've been testing is list scrubbers. And if anybody here has insights on somebody who does this, the groups that go out and to scrub your list that I've looked at or that our team has looked at have been incredibly expensive. And I haven't found a good solution in that area. And if there's a provider out there who can do the job right at a fair price, we'd like to know about that. We may do some testing on their effectiveness. Moving on, plan your message format. This is important. One of the things that we've done many times when we've been called in to optimize in a research test with one of our research partners, a mailing, we've done a lot of that. We've seen huge, huge gains done properly. I remember one group we went in, recrafted their message, and sent it on Wednesday. Thursday was a record day. We thought that was perhaps a fluke. We did the same thing the following Wednesday, and the following Thursday was again a record day. And that's all because the messaging of the email changed was far very, very important. We did the same thing with the New York Times on their news tracker service when they take it from free to paid, and we worked through that messaging and testing. One of the things that we discovered, we're going to talk to you about right now, and that is something you may already be beginning to, I think the net is starting to wake up to this. We've been saying it for 3 years, but most spam is HTML formatted, and most legitimate email is HTML formatted. But the reality is, plain text alternative messages, should be sent with every HTML message, because if they don't have HTML, you need a good plain text alternative message. But even more, we've discovered that HTML emails actually bounce more often than text-based messages. And in a study that we recently did, 2.3% of the HTML messages bounced, while 1.15% of the text messages bounced. And I was just speaking in New York yesterday, actually, and the day before, at the subscribers conference, or the subscription publishers conference for Sherpa. One of the numbers that came out of that conference was that in another study, 2.03% of Gmail emails were opened, whereas 4.76% of text emails were opened. What you need to understand is that HTML email gets rejected by ESPs and spam filters twice as often as plain text. Now, this conference that we're doing right now, we're not charging you. MEC's entire site is also free. But without doing a complicated research project with us, what you may discover is that many of you could double the response to your emails now by simply developing a smart plain text format. You may also want to consider what we call light HTML, and that is HTML that feels like plain text. The only color or difference that you use is subtle. Less is more. In the absence of a lot of color, just a little color can make a significant difference. In the absence of a lot of graphics, just one graphic can make a significant difference. Most of the major sites we review when we're conducting research for many of the major brands have too many graphics competing with each other on their pages. I don't want to get off topic, but we actually measure and weight every element on a page when we're conducting research. We say, what's the objective of this page? How does this element contribute to the objective? An element might be an email capture form. It might be a graphic with an ad. It might be top 10 products listing, but it's some component of the page. We then say, adding up to 100, what percentage should this weigh? What percentage should this weigh? What percentage should this weigh in terms of its priority? This should get 50% of our eyes' attention. This should get 20% of our eyes' attention, and this should get, 20% of our eyes' attention, and this should get 10%. Based on that, we will use five elements: size, color, motion, shape, and position to determine what your eyes see first, second, and third, and control your eye path on the page. Here at the lab, we can actually take and watch your eyes and your mouse simultaneously and record the whole process when someone's moving through a site to see if what we guessed was right. But over and over again, you can do that. And you really don't need sophisticated heat tracking modules like some of you may have seen on the internet to accomplish that. Candidly, we can predict eye path before we ever turn on the computers and start the lab. So think of that and think about the importance of a plain text email strategy. Also, send legitimate content. Now, I know this is not a message about optimizing your email messaging, but I will tell you this. Most emails that are sent are a dismal failure when it comes to getting sales. Some big brands brag because they get a high response, but their high response is actually quite low. It's just high for them, and it's high only because their brand is well known and because their list is so huge. So they don't like the best copy, but they're sending it out to 700,000 names, and their brand is known. Some smaller companies without that advantage, many of them that we've talked to, just really don't have a lot of success with email. A, they don't capture enough, and by the way, if you're wondering what you should be capturing, a good benchmark is 5% of the people who visit your site should give you their email address. If you're not getting 5%, you're leaving a lot of money on the table, because that 5% can often translate into significant revenue, and it also can reduce overall what you're paying for your marketing costs. Because why pay again to get that same person back to your site in the pay-per-click engines or some other way when you got them there the first time? We do not put enough emphasis on email capture, and we certainly do it wrong. Most of the time, we're just telling them to sign up here, register here. There's not one bit of incentive in the way we do it. But a smart email capture process can make a significant difference in a site's revenue. We've seen it over and over again. We worked with a major publisher 4 months ago on a project that we're still working on. 30 days in, our second test, one change with email capture. Overall conversion of the site went up something approaching 30%. 30% is a huge gain in revenue when your costs haven't gone up one bit. So may I point out for you that you need to think about your emails, and candidly, most of the way we deliver sales emails from a retailer standpoint is just atrocious. They only work because it's close to a holiday or there's some special reason why people are incentivized. We have found that if you add value to that email, it's way more powerful. One of the smartest things we've done with a research partner, and I'll tell you this, at the risk of destroying its competitive advantage, is created something we call the lowest price survey. As a retailer, when you're trying to figure out how can I write an email that anybody cares about, I'm not a publisher. We came up with a concept where we actually took, using the comparison search engines to index it, we created an email that said, as of 4.05 p.m. today, these are the best prices on items X, Y, Z, and they were listed and ranked in order of 10. And we advised the retailer, because we knew his pricing in this case would be very competitive, we advised him to even put competitors on there,
I don't know where you put it.
8 out of 10 of those top listings were probably theirs, and as a result, they saw significant traffic. My point is that email served. It really served the person because they had signed up for the lowest price survey. The products that we were featuring were the most popular products. We knew that from the searches on the site and from actually from offline publications that we were studying. So they were very attractive products, and we literally provided a service by saying, hey, here's the best place on the internet to get these, and we verified it with a third-party source, and we sent it out. It was very popular. Now, I give you that only because the truth is there are smart ways to send your email so that they do more than simply scream at people, buy something from me, but they actually give them something of value. They serve them, they help them, they inform them. We would suggest that you do that. We also suggest that you're very careful about you know, who you permit to advertise. Research potential newsletter advertisers before allowing them to place ads in your publication, your newsletter. If they have used their website URL to send spam, just having their URL appear in your newsletter could cause the entire message to be blocked or filtered. Also, choose your language carefully when crafting messages. Avoid topics often found in spam, such as medication, mortgages, making money, and any type of words connected to the pornography industry. If you do not need to use words that might be filtered, don't attempt to obfuscate words with extra characters or odd spelling. You'll just make your message appear more like spam. And also with images, this is if you're going to HTML, avoid creating messages that are made up entirely of images. Use images sparingly, if at all. Much open rate tracking technology uses images to calculate the number of open messages. You may choose to disable this kind of tracking to avoid being filtered based on image content. And then attachments.
Wow.
The virus is running rampant and spreading through the malicious email attachments. Many users are wary of unattached documents. So be very, very careful about that. It's usually better to use a website URL to link to or files they can download, and this will eliminate fear of attachments on the part of the recipients and also reduce the overall message size. So those six things are done, plus the seventh is really addressing what we talked about. Make sure you're can spam compliant, and that was what we did with those first big 6 points that we discussed. Finally, join the reputation service. A reputation service is, for instance, a large ISP that has a strong policy to vet email senders regarding their email practices and policies. Businesses listed with these services are given less stringent filtering or no filtering at all because the actual provider himself is compliant and they know that they police their list carefully. Also, try to get on the whitelist. It's essential to contact major ISPs and email providers about your permission-based email. Many large providers such as AOL and Yahoo have specific whitelisting programs and Postmaster website areas to ensure your email is delivered as long as you meet their opt-in list policies and procedures. Oh, while no single tip will enable you to get 100% of your email delivered, each one can go a long way to reaching that goal. Email deliverability is about combating the effects of spam to ensure the requested opt-in email is delivered to the intended recipient. And these techniques will help you do that. All right. I'm going to take these last few moments, and I'm going to ask, A, if you have any questions. Now's your chance. And B, from my own team that are on right now, Jalali, would you add anything to this? Would you like to point out anything that you'd add? You know, I want to point out that I'm presenting, but Jalali is the highly skilled researcher behind this piece and has done both of the writing and so on.
There isn't any. They can't take money that
I don't have anything to add other than you know, I want to thank Tom Kolzer and Ann Mitchell, who have definitely helped. Both those people are really knowledgeable on email marketing in general. The other thing I wanted to add was that the data that we originally presented at the beginning of this, the sort of the case study on the retailer that had received spam complaints, he hasn't, you know, that company has not obviously been prosecuted or anything like that, but just one thing to point out is the provider that they were using actually suspended their account just because of some of these complaints. And, you know, while they'll be getting back up and going soon, it's cost them several months of business. We actually missed some of the major holidays sending legitimate coupons out to some fast customers just because the, you know, essentially they froze the account while we figured some of the stuff out. So
I think that's a huge risk. Jelani, I think I'm glad you pointed out, because where I've seen the greatest risk is an ISP just not going to take any chances. He'll just shut you down. You may be as legitimate as can be. He'll shut you down and won't even return your phone calls. You'll just get notified. Often you won't have 24 hours. And it's really, really quite dangerous for someone who's not paying careful attention.
Okay, I have can I ask a question?
Just a sec. Yes, go right ahead.
Just a question about messaging in the subject line of an email. I understand what you said about, you know, anything about money or porno or anything like that. But a question I'm often asked is, if we have the subject line as a question, is that more likely to wind up as spam, if it's phrased as a question?
Can I get, I'd like to get, can I, could we get your first name and perhaps the company you're with? Unless it's tricky.
Yes,
and
it's Lonnie with Computer Associates.
Okay. And you're asking, let me rephrase the question to make sure I understood it. You're asking about the subject line, and is there something strategic we should be doing in our subject lines to prevent?
Well, yes, and also a lot of times we go back and forth, you know, to try to get the, you know, the most open rates on the subject line.
Yes.
And we're often afraid to ask a question in the subject line, like, do you want to, I don't know, solve this problem, or are you looking into this, or as a question rather than phrasing it? And I go back and forth with that, and the question I'm asking is, if you phrase something in the subject as a question, and I don't know if this is true or not, is it more likely to be perceived as spam if there's a question mark in that subject line?
Good. That's a good question. I'll let my team answer first. Go ahead, guys.
Tom, are you online, Tom Colzer? No, I guess not. I don't think that there's any set. There's not like an association of spam filters or anything like that that I'm aware of. But it's essentially what it comes down to is that all the spam filters are doing, they're looking for patterns in emails, things that might indicate spam. And so what I would do is I would actually test. With the question, without the question, if you have a significant difference in open rate or conversion or deliverability, then I would say that the customers that you're sending to, you know, their spam filters are picking that up as spam.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, I'm done. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I know of nothing that's automatic and connected with the question. But I would suggest two things. One, I'll do a little research on our own to see if there's something we might not know about this. But secondly, the way we test subject lines is we do subsamplings of our list, and very quickly you can see if you have a problem with that. And I think sometimes questions are good. But often, if you use a question, it's good to start with a topic, colon, and then question. Do you know why? Because the way people look at email, they can't often see the whole subject line.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure the first word is something that already is the attention getter. If you know anything about direct mail, I'm sure you do, in any writing you have an attention getter and an interest builder. And the attention getter sometimes is your headline, and the interest builder sometimes is your first your first sentence on that lead paragraph, and that drives them into the body of the story. But in direct mail, in email it's compressed because they often can't read your email until they click. So your subject line must play the role of both attention getter and interest builder. I would suggest that one of the things you should look to is that your first word or two is a very compelling word that gets their attention. And so phrase your question so that word is up front, or phrase your question after, you know, a subject colon question.
Okay. Thank you very much for that.
Certainly. Certainly. Any other questions?
I have one.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
This is Doug from Investing Systems.
Yes.
I would like to know if there's an optimal time span to routinely mail your list to keep your list active.
That's a smart question.
Weekly versus, you know, sometimes I mail my list.
Let me answer that by saying I have not done that research recently, but I have done it in the past. And in my last study, I came to the conclusion that you do not want to contact your email list less than twice a month or once every 14 days. Monthly on email tends to draw such a large lapse between when they signed up and when they get the piece that they forget they've signed up. You lose the sense of community. So I would suggest that not less than 14 days is the generic answer, Doug, and it might be something we need to research again. I think optimum, there's an optimum, the safest number ranges 7 days or 14 days. The danger, the other danger, you know, I can tell you this from an extreme standpoint. When it's longer than 14 days, you got significant risk. When it's more than 7 days, you've got significant risk. Very few people can stand a daily.
Right.
And if you're going to get a daily, you need to make sure that A, they want a daily, and B, if they decide it's too much, they have an option for a digest or for something. Otherwise, don't make their only choice a daily or nothing.
Oh, and so they could opt out of the daily by subscribing to the weekly?
Yeah. Yep.
Good idea.
Good idea.
Because then they can set their own preferences.
You got it. You got it.
Good idea.
And it's a great way to keep from losing good people who like what you're doing, but they just can't, they don't have the bandwidth to put up with a daily from you and everything else.
I'm very interested in today's call because I've been writing a newsletter for 5 years that I can't get at my inbox.
You know, your own?
There are problems with email.
Oh, my gosh.
Critical Path takes me out at the server-side level from my own service provider. But, you know, my subscribers get them, so, you know.
We know who you are, Doug. You're just evil, and the whole Internet knows it, so you can't get away with it. Okay.
My name is Cheryl Gonzalez, and I actually have an autoresponder service, and I can sort of answer that question. Especially with retailers, when they actually get a customer to opt into their list, they really do need to send, like, consistent messages for a couple of days before they start spacing out.
Yes, that's a very good point. That's exactly right. And as a reminder, and as a matter of fact, the first three communications you send to a new subscriber are among the very most critical.
Yes.
And those need to be thoroughly optimized and absolutely tested. And if you cross-sell or upsell like some of us do in our research, it's almost important that you're very low-key about any cross-sell or upsell in the beginning. And certainly don't associate it with any types of confirmation messages at all.
I have an interesting study I would like to see.
All right, go ahead.
If we were to, say, craft a set of, like, three follow-ups that would go out after an initial value proposition sign-up, what percentage of the list could you get whitelisted if like, you really focused that in like, part of every one of those first messages? Because it seems to me that's the solution in the long run, is to get whitelisted. If the medium is email, then the whitelist is the answer, right?
Well, I think so, and I think you also have to do, you know, provide sufficient incentive, which will either be your content or an additional incentive that you need for this to happen. And I think one of the biggest reasons to move people to whitelist, and I mean this in a positive way, but it's fear. It's hard to say, you know, whitelist me and we'll give you this. You can't really get away with that. But let them know what's coming up and what they're going to miss that they really want and need. If they don't take a few moments to get your email whitelisted, that makes a huge difference in response. Most of us take the time to whitelist something because we're afraid we're going to miss out.
Can I ask a question about whitelisting real quick?
Certainly. And is this the same or is this a new person?
No, I'm sorry. This is a new person. This is Kelly Gleason from Knightsbridge.
Okay.
When you talk about that, are you saying that you need to contact the actual subscriber themselves and ask them to work through their
Yes.
Technology people to whitelist you?
Yes.
Okay.
No, not their technology people. I mean, yeah, I mean, if you can get them to do it across their intranet or whatever, that's wonderful. But we're saying that most people have their own spam filter system now with its own
like
built-in whitelist.
Oh, like a proceeding or something that...
Yes, yes.
And
it would be great if, you know, we know the top three or four whitelist filters and in your instructions, you actually had a link to step-by-step instructions that you wrote.
That's what I was going to suggest.
Yeah, I mean,
we have that for Outlook 2000, AOL 9, AOL 8, all the big providers, Yahoo, Hotmail, and it's a set of instructions for how to whitelist.
That's a lot of times the software itself doesn't do a very good job. And if you're really smart about doing that and you really write it properly, then all they got to do is if they're not sure how to whitelist, click the link and you show them how. And that's very helpful. And I, you know, I think there's some other things that you may do like that, but that's what I've found. Does that answer your question, Kelly?
Sort of. We have an issue where we use a provider to send out our emails for us.
Okay.
And we get reports back on, you know, all the soft bounces. So we research and try to figure out which of those were captured by the spam filters.
Yes.
So we have that list, and we just haven't been sure now what to do with it. So, you know, we're not mailing anything to those people, but we're kind of stagnating because we're just unsure of how to go about solving that problem. And the vendor has, you know, a very limited way of helping us. And then beyond that, it's, you know, on a consulting basis.
So you don't have any way to even talk to these people because you were whitelisted immediately, correct?
We haven't been whitelisted.
No, I mean, you weren't, I'm sorry, I said that incorrectly. Because you weren't whitelisted, the very first communication you sent to them was caught by their filter, is that correct?
Yes.
The only way I know that you can deal with that is by changing the process on the sign-up end so that you have a way to communicate with them, so that you either ask for an alternative email address or you have some other form or fashion, because there's no way to talk to those people about getting you out of their filter.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's possible that what has been captured, and we don't even know the answer to this, is whether they've blocked our domain or one of the domains that our service provider is using. So would it be reasonable that we could maybe send an email, a text-based email from our system internally to those people saying, if you would like to continue receiving this, you know, please.
I think that's reasonable as long as they've signed up. And particularly if this is text-based, were your primary message is HTML, the ones you sent before?
Yeah, I think it was.
Oh, then try plain text. That'll make a difference right there.
Okay.
But bear in mind that there are certain things like Curb, for instance, which the only people it lets through are the people in your contact list. So everyone by default is blacklisted, so to speak. The only people on the whitelist are the one in your Outlook contacts, which means that there are some filters out there that you just can't get through with anything.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But plain text will help you get through quite a few just like that. I'd also check and make sure my service provider, they won't tell you this, but some of the email service providers are themselves blacklisted. I mean, you know, there's big ones like Sparklist, who's not, but has been in trouble, even though they didn't do anything that I know of that was wrong, but they fought to maintain, because they're owned by Lyris, one of the major systems, and, you know, they maintained it. But, I mean, they've struggled to stay in good terms with all the ISPs. There are others, some very well-known ones on the Internet that themselves are blacklisted on a number of major ISPs. So I would start out, too, by making sure that you're not using the wrong email provider.
Yeah, okay.
But anyway, perhaps I would do that, and then I'd try to plain text.
Okay.
And then I would also look at my sign-up process. They should see right there on the site or wherever it is that they give you your email address that they may need to change their email settings so that they can get the email from you that has the, and whatever it's in it that you think they want or need or are most interested in.
Okay.
Bhutan Barrett, I have a question.
Yes.
I'm sorry, I've been in and out. I was on a cell phone earlier that kept going crazy on me, so someone may have asked this. But are you doing research also on the B2B side?
Yes, we are.
Okay, and so this pretty much, this discussion was B2C, correct?
Well,
it could apply both ways.
Well, I'd like to point out something because we're finding, and I'm a direct marketing agency person, and we've been doing emailings since the beginning, and we specialize in high-tech companies, so obviously, you know, the beginning was the beginning, and a lot of the advice that's been given in the B2C world is really sort of 180 degrees different than our experience. So I think traditionally in direct marketing, there's always been sort of enormous differences between B2C and B2B, and I would be hesitant to make assumptions based on the B2C and apply them directly to B2B.
Well, I'll tell you this.
It's all the same protocol, though.
Well, I'm talking about, for example, text only. I'm talking about sometimes you see advice for multiple links in offers, et cetera, and I could name three or four pieces of advice given rather consistently in B2C by Marketing Sherpa and then in today's conversation. And I'm saying to you that they violate some basic principles of direct marketing in general, and then specifically that has not been our experience in email in the B2B world. And it's very different. We're relatively unconcerned, for example, with AOL and bandwidth issues. So both in terms of content and process. It's not to say we don't have enormous spam issues, and most of those are coming in the B2B environment from the B2C side. As you all know, at work, unfortunately, we're getting the drugs, the pornography, the Nigerian letter please. Where in mail, of course, the business address and the home address are quite distinct. So this is a big blur. So certainly, increasing the better business practices, which in B2C certainly are very key to us in B2B, but I'm saying that some of the advice I would be hesitant to follow.
Well, I tell you this, we work in both, and we publish B2B, and we ourselves publish in the B2B world. And candidly, for instance, I'd like to see what, some of the data, or you could have a conversation with one of our people in your position. It would be helpful. I'm open to any of those thoughts, but some of these things, for instance, we've tested plain text against HTML, B2B and B2C, and on the B2B side, plain text has outpulled HTML virtually every time.
Well, so, that may be true, and let me emphasize here that direct mail outperforms email so outstandingly that one wonders why you're even doing email anymore. Mm-hmm. But having said that, there are a number of issues in terms of beyond just measurability, but taking action. And I will tell you that the products and services that we are not direct selling, for example, we're lead generation, which would be very different than a direct sales environment. We're very offer driven in terms of highly valuable information. So any discussion of any kind of comparison would have to address specifically the objective of the email or mail and the offer, and of course, the person's relationship. I mean, it's so
critical, but it, in a sense, it pulls us from the topic here because
right. I'm just pointing out that I've listened to some very good advice, and I just think that there is a very big difference. And I would not generalize from one to the other.
It may be that we'll do a separate report on B2B, but I would suggest for this report, the CAN Spam Act is critical for all of us. Those six steps
yes.
outlined are critical for all of us, and the problem in this report is critical for all of us because we're all getting barraged at work as well as at home.
Yes.
And most of these practices, are critical for us, but I would certainly entertain any thoughts someone has about specific B2B needs. We're very active in direct mail as well, and we're researching offline and online and television media, and so there's some other principles out there that may apply, and we're certainly open to thoughts on that. You're welcome to email us, and maybe there's some things we can look at. And I just met for 2 days with a number of B2B, publishers, and a good point. And we're going to probably have to close this down. Is there one more question before I do that?
I have one again. This is Kelly Gleason again.
Okay. Go ahead.
You mentioned that you should scrub your list fairly regularly for unproductive names.
Yes.
At what point do you consider a name to be unproductive?
Well, I measure that in two or three different ways. One, of course, is undeliverability. Another is unopens. And a third way has to do with a principle in marketing called recency, which has to do with how productive or how frequently, when is the last time they ordered from you as a measure or metric to determine when they're going to order in the future. Now, recency is not as important in direct mail as it is, I mean, sorry, in email as it is in direct mail, because your cost to send an email are much lower than direct mail.
Uh-huh.
So when you're working with a direct mail list, you don't want to pay the cost to get to a person who you can tell from his recency and his orders is likely not going to place an order. At the same time, you want to send your highest value orders to those who you think, I mean, those who are, you can select certain people based on their ordering pattern and know that they're likely to be good candidates for your next offer, and they should be among the first. You can also separate those people out when you're studying or testing a list because you know that they're going to skew your numbers with more orders than what would be, you know, the general portion of your list will receive. On the internet, I think it mainly has to do with, you know, deliverability.
Okay, so maybe if nobody's opened your thing in 6 months or a year or something, you take them off your list.
I think that, you know, there's a lot, there, someone might argue that later they might become effective. You may want to keep all that's deliverable, but those are the two factors, and it depends on the size of your list. When the mailing becomes, when your email list becomes large, then, you know, there's cost savings by eliminating people who are just not productive to mail to. And
okay,
those are two factors that impact that.
Okay, thank
and,
you.
And 6 months is a good number.
Okay.
And depending, it depends on your product and its cycle. That's why I can't give you a firm number, you know, as
sure,
to how long that should be. But very good. All right. Well, listen, we appreciate, if you found this helpful, please let us know. Please send us an email if you found this helpful, or let us help us understand how to keep serving you. And we'll keep conducting research. And we appreciate everyone's participation today. Okay? Thank you.